You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Morning again to everybody. I'm Fiona Hill, the Director of the Centre on the US and Europe here at Brookings. I'm really delighted to see that all of you have braved the typically hot Washington, D.C. and steamy weather to come here to the cooler climes of transatlantic relations and Europe. We're really delighted this morning to kick off the first panel on our annual conference on transatlantic relations that we organize in close partnership with the Heinrich Böll Foundation. We'd like to thank Sebastian Graffa and his other colleagues from Heinrich Böll for making this possible. Today's event comes also on the heels of a workshop that we did yesterday with the people who are appearing on our panels today, a very small group who got together to brainstorm on some of the critical issues on the transatlantic agenda. We organized that in conjunction with partners from the European Council on Foreign Relations, and we're very pleased to have Mark Leonard from the Council here today on the panel, and the Bertelsmann Foundation, along with Heinrich Böll, our partner for today's conference. The meetings yesterday focused on some of the critical issues on the agenda, like dealing with Russia, China, Iran, and Afghanistan, Pakistan. But what we wanted to do today in this forum with all of you here is talk about some of the bigger issues related to Europe and the transformation of Europe. You'll see from today's panel that we're coyly beginning with the idea of the beginning of Europe with the Lisbon Treaty, and ending with what we hope clearly is not the end of Europe with the economic crisis. But we hope to be provocative by getting people to think about these issues. Well, then the questions in the middle of the futures of European enlargement and what to do with an incorporated Europe, the neighbourhood, which of course includes a large number of countries that either have a prospect or at least a desire for entry into the European Union, or at least in many cases, the hope of a partnership, a close partnership with Europe moving forward. So what we wanted to do with this first panel is really talk about, along with you in the audience, about what the Lisbon Treaty has really meant for the development of Europe, and also what the implications are of the Lisbon Treaty for relations with the United States. And how we'd like to structure this today, each of our panelists will have 5 to 8 minutes of just some opening comments, and then we'll throw it open to you for comments and questions and for discussion. We'd like to start with Heather Connolly, our colleague from the CSIS just down the road, who we've asked to give a perspective from the viewpoint of the United States, a non-government perspective on expectations that the US and the analytical community and others may have had about the developments in Europe after the Lisbon Treaty. We'll then talk to Mark Leonard from the European Council on Foreign Relations to do the same from the European perspective. I've also asked Mark if he can comment a little bit on the implications of some of the recent elections in Europe. Mark obviously sits in London, where there's been some extremely interesting developments in the UK elections, and how this may or may not be affected by the various changes within Europe. So Mark is a bit of a tall order here because, of course, Europe is still the conglomeration of states as well as the EU itself, and Heather just has to deal with the United States. But anyway, we're sure that Mark can handle all of that. We're then going to turn to Andres Ortega, who is a representative here of the Spanish presidency of the European Union and works actually directly in the Spanish president's office. Obviously, the Spaniards have had a rather interesting experience over the last several months of having the rotating presidency of the EU at a time of rather dramatic change as well as of crisis. They seem to have weathered it quite well. Andres is looking remarkably fit and healthy given the traumas of the last 6 months. And we asked Andres if he could give us some observations on what it's been like from the inner workings of the EU in the wake of the Lisbon Treaty. And then we're going to end with Jeremy Shapiro from the European Bureau at the Department of State. Many of you will know Jeremy in his previous guise as one of our Brookings colleagues who's written a great deal about Europe. And Jeremy now is literally inside the the factory of sausage making on EU policy, and we'd like Jeremy to comment on what it looks like from this perspective. Although Jeremy, many of you will remember, is rather used to be one of our rather more unrestrained commentators, so we'll actually see what life inside the State Department has done for him. And he has a couple of minders from the State Department here, and as we want him to come back again, make sure you don't provoke him too much. Anyway, we'll turn over to Heather and get things started. And thank you again to everyone for joining us.
Oh, thank you very much, Fiona. I am ready, Jeremy, for your liberation. I'm ready. Thank you again. Thank you so much, both to Brookings and to the organizing partners. It is a privilege to be here. It is a privilege to be among such good colleagues and experts and friends. And I have to say, here in Washington, we don't speak enough about Europe. We don't study Europe anymore. Our graduate programs are very small. Our transatlantic programs are very small. And we need to understand and have a better understanding of the fundamental transformation that is occurring in Europe today. And this conference is in a very important part of what I see as a continuing education process that needs to occur here in Washington. So I'm delighted to be with you all today. I have to say, I have to quarrel a little bit with the title of our panel, The Beginning of Europe, because my argument is that it's not the beginning of Europe. We're actually closing a very important historic chapter in transatlantic relations, the post-Cold War chapter. And we haven't yet started to write the next chapter. And I think there are a couple of questions to this. Who writes this next chapter? Is it a transatlantic co-authorship where both are writing it? Does Europe write this narrative of what the next chapter in transatlantic relations, U.S.-European, U.S.-EU relations look like? Does the U.S. even have the energy and the focus and the enthusiasm to actually write a chapter? And what do we want this transatlantic story to say? How do we want it to continue? And I'm afraid it's going to be a very new narrative. And we have to have the courage, and I think particularly Europe has to have the courage to realize that this relationship, the narrative to the next, to the story, is going to be far different today and into the future as it was for the last 60 years. And we have to have the courage to rewrite that chapter. I would argue that the chapter basically closed in 2004. And I just want to step a moment back. 2001, the first time an Article 5 commitment was ever made, and no one thought, this was the twist to this narrative, no one ever thought that the first time an Article 5 commitment would be made would be in the defense of the United States. That was never even thought of. We had the EU-NATO Big Bang in 2004, where really the historic transformation of Central and Eastern Europe occurred, and it was a great transatlantic project. We had, obviously, the constitutional process that began in Europe, a longer road that many thought, took some twists and turns on its own narrative, but finally concluded in the Lisbon process. We also had, at the very end of that chapter, Iraq and the divisiveness between the United States and Europe. And I would argue we also saw some very historic actions in Russia with the Khodorkovsky trial and really the transformation of President Putin and his role in Russia. And I think we've been without a narrative for the last 6 years. We've been trying to determine what that narrative is. Some have argued, well, it was, you know, the Iraq War and President Bush and unilateralism, and that was sort of the defining narrative of the last 6 years. Some would argue, no, the new narrative is looking at 2008 and President Sarkozy and the role of the EU presidency and the EU negotiating the ceasefire agreement and Georgia, the Georgia-Russian conflict, redefining this narrative of transatlantic relations. I'm not sure of that. I think, again, we were absent of the narrative, and we needed to try to point to directions because we hadn't defined what this new relationship would look like. Certainly Europe had hoped and had the greatest expectation that the Lisbon Treaty would be that new narrative. And as of December 1st of last year, this would be truly the beginning of Europe, which is quite right, as the panel title suggests. But look what happened after December 1st. And Andreas, I'm going to steal from you a little bit and some comments you have made earlier. 2 weeks later, the Copenhagen Climate Change Conference occurred. And when Europe was at its greatest moment of expectation that had arrived, this was the new narrative, it found itself not in the room, at the table, on an issue that it found to be the most important issue, an issue of national security to Europe, which is climate change. And every European political leader that had a visit to Washington and met with President Obama made a beeline to Capitol Hill. Why? Because they wanted Congress to pass substantial climate change legislation. European leadership. This was Europe articulating a position, a far-reaching position, and wanting to bring the rest of the world along. And what happened? They were excluded from the room. A deal was made without them, and an issue of great importance. What a great blow. Several months later, obviously the cancellation of the U.S.-EU summit. Another great blow. Maybe perhaps not unexpected that it wasn't a ripe time for an agenda, but how it was communicated, I think, was extremely disturbing to Europe, that it was sort of discovered in a leaked press story. That's unfortunate. And then finally, the Eurozone crisis, another extraordinary challenge to the EU. Europe's beginning has not been very smooth or easy, and this has now created what is our new narrative. Perhaps the United States is beginning to spell out its new narrative. And if you haven't had a chance to look at the new national security strategy, I recommend it. You can zoom to page 40 or 41. That's sort of where Europe is mentioned in the national security strategy. I haven't read the whole thing, true confession, but I will suggest that there's not a lot of Europe in it specifically. It does talk about the critical nature of allies. There's some very nice language. It's a beautifully written document about the importance of allies. And I want to read you one sentence from it, page 41. The foundation of the United States' regional and global security will remain America's relations with our allies, and our commitment to their security is unshakable. These relationships must be constantly cultivated. And it goes on. So perhaps the next chapter is how we cultivate. Because I think, if you want to use a chapter analogy, maybe we have to go to gardening and think about how we cultivate allies that we've known for a while. They aren't growing powers. They aren't emerging economies, but they're our allies. We know them well. Perhaps we know them so well we don't need to focus our attention and our time on them. And so perhaps the U.S. is trying to understand how we cultivate Europe today. How do you cultivate the EU at a time when it's under extraordinary institutional transformation? But the problem with cultivation is that transatlantic relations has now become transactional relations. Because the U.S. agenda is comprised of Afghanistan, Iran, arms control, non-proliferation would be the four that I would tease out. Europe is part of those priorities, but they are by no means the focus of those priorities. They are a contributor, but they are not an essential partner. And that makes that cultivation that much more challenging. I've heard over the last several days that Europe just doesn't understand U.S. policy. This is a psychological phenomena of Europe. They're very concerned and they're anxiety-ridden. We have to focus on substance, not format. Again, I'm trying to understand how we cultivate the U.S.-EU relationship amongst all of this, because we have to be very, very realistic about the next chapter that we're going to, I hope, jointly write together. We have to realize our limitations, the incredible domestic distractions that we face today here in Washington, obviously, the oil spill, upcoming midterm elections, an economy, high unemployment. That's a huge domestic focus. And the national security strategy underscores that if we are not great at home, we cannot be great abroad. And that's an important message, but it's also it will be a focus domestically. Europe is increasingly domestically focused and challenged because of the economic crisis and the political fallout from that. The U.S. is a global actor, and Europe is not. And that is a fundamental challenge that we have to face. So when we talk about China, when we talk about rising powers, it's very difficult to have that conversation with the EU because they have not defined that policy per se. We have to understand that there's amazing transformations going on in Europe, not just the Lisbon Treaty, which it is, but I would argue that here in Washington, it's very difficult to find even a handful of people who know and understand the difference between the Council, the Commission, Lady Ashton's new role. I defy you to find more than 10 people who can articulate that triangle. So if we don't understand it, if we don't have people to explore it, and it seems so complicated, and we're so busy, the reaction, and it's completely understandable, is when you get it together, let me know. Let me know. And that just causes the frustration and the anxiety to grow, because Europe feels as if you don't understand. Perhaps they understand U.S. policy, but I think the fear is that from Europe is Washington doesn't understand where Europe is and where it's evolving. We have to realize that Europe is changing. We have to manage together transatlantically the devolution of Russia and the evolution of Turkey. And that's a very difficult conversation to have between the U.S. and the EU. There's no consensus within the EU on those two, and there's certainly not necessarily transatlantic unity on that. Beware when we start waxing nostalgic about the U.S.-European relationship. That means we're a little empty on the intellectual rigor that we need to provide that next chapter, that next narrative. We wax about how devoted we are to the transatlantic relationship, but we have to start formulating the strategic thought to get there. And then finally, I would argue that we probably the best place to start with this new narrative, which I think it's a new paradigm for the U.S.-EU relationship in a post-Lisbon Treaty framework, is in fact what the next panel is going to talk about, and that's the Eastern Partnership. The most successful transatlantic policy was the enlargement of NATO and EU to include the transformation of Central and Eastern Europe. And after about 2008, arguably 2009, that policy has now run out of intellectual gas. And we haven't defined where we go from here. We have some architecture which is known as the Eastern Partnership. I don't believe the United States has defined its own forward-looking strategy for the post-Soviet space and the Western Balkans. That is a great place to begin a successful narrative, I believe, for U.S.-EU cooperation. And let's not focus on necessarily the photo op or the summit meeting, but let's focus on the substance, but let's also understand this is not about just the U.S. agenda of Afghanistan, Iran, other issues. It's about true partnership and making sure we're also understanding where Europe's needs and concerns are. And that, to me, is an exciting chapter that I'd like to be seen written, but we have to have the courage to do that. Thank you.
Thanks, Heather. Mark?
Thank you. I'm going to start by reading you an unsolicited email I got yesterday. Dear Mark, yesterday I saw a large stack of your first book, Why Europe Will Run the 21st Century, at a bookstore in Corona, California. They're on sale for $1. Another customer and I laughed at the title. I've been to Europe several times and love it, but why can't you all just face it? The US will always be the most powerful country in the world. Period. Samuel Martinez Steger, proud fifth-generation Mexican-American. Luckily, I gave myself a whole century for the prediction in the title to be borne out. And I'm not going to go into the complexities of my argument about the changing nature of political power and how I never actually argue that Europe be the most powerful economic or political power, but that the European way of doing things is well suited to the world's way of doing things. But the email kind of reminded me a bit about the thinking behind this event when we first started talking about it. And we did think that that this was going to be Europe's moment, that the Lisbon Treaty was going to be a moment of triumph. You know, we've been through this painful process of institutional stasis, and, you know, we thought that the next few months would be marked by hope and by audacity and all sorts of other wonderful things. And instead, we're meeting at a time of real existential crisis, a deeper one than we've had for a very long period of time. I know that the third session is going to go into much more detail on the euro and those sorts of problems, but I think it's slightly artificial not to mention it at all. So I'm going to try and do four things in my remarks. First of all, to remind ourselves why we were excited about Lisbon. Secondly, to talk about some of the effects that the crisis might have on Europe as a foreign policy actor in particular, rather than on the economics. Thirdly, to talk a bit about the politics and the outlook of EU leaders, as Fiona asked me to do. And finally, to look at some of the implications for the transatlantic relationship. So the first point is why were people excited about Lisbon? And the backdrop is really quite straightforward. If you look at the European Union in terms of its power against other powers in the world, its capacity is actually pretty significant. The European market is the biggest single market in the world. European Union spends more on defence than anyone else on the planet, 10 times what the, or 12 times what the Russians spend on defence every year. Two-thirds of global development aid comes from Europeans. We have more diplomats than anybody else, over 50,000 stationed in different places, and you know, peacekeepers in every continent on the planet. And yet, there is an obvious fact that the European Union continues to punch well below its weight. Its power is fragmented. It's unable to turn this economic heft into real political influence. And I think the idea behind Lisbon was actually to start helping the European Union translate some of these power resources into real influence. And there was a big fuss made about the presidency of the council, because Tony Blair flirted with was quite keen to get the job. But actually, I think that was quite a big distraction. The interesting thing about the Lisbon Treaty and the real innovation was the creation of this double-hatted high representative, sometimes called the European Foreign Minister. And what was exciting about that post was that it brought together two existing roles, one which had political legitimacy, the role which Javier Solana used to do, which had the political legitimacy of representing the member states and the backing of the member states, with the financial clout and the ability to integrate different strands of policy which the European Commission had. Just as important was the creation of a European diplomatic service, the External Action Service, with thousands of people, so that there'll be European embassies all over the globe, which will be quite a transformative change to European foreign policy, because I discovered recently that there are 70 countries in the world where less than three European member states have embassies. So 90% of the European Union doesn't have a presence on the ground in a third of the world's countries. So actually having European embassies will actually feed back and create more of a strategic culture. But also, I think even more importantly than that is the way that these embassies will work on the ground. I remember talking to Chris Patten when these ideas first came out, and he just left Brussels. But he said that people have underestimated the way that having a single person on the ground in somewhere like Kiev or Cairo, who local people talk to about trade, about aid, about foreign policy, about human rights, will totally transform the nature of the European Union as an actor. Because in these countries, the European Union is a hyperpower. We are the biggest source of trade, of aid. It's our neighbourhood. And yet, it's completely easy to ignore the European Union on anything, because you speak to different people about these different portfolios. So there's no way that power could be leveraged. And Patton used the example of Bosnia, where all these things were brought together under a high rep, and showed that there was a sort of Darwinian struggle going on between the national embassies and the European high rep, where eventually it became clear that the go-to person was not the British ambassador or the French ambassador or the German ambassador, it was the European Union special representative. And he kind of argued that that's what will happen to the European Union. That sort of process of creating that is well underway. Cathy Ashton, the high rep, came up with a plan, presented it to member states who've signed it off, and we're now going through the kind of usual bureaucratic processes, which will carry on for many months. It's like a transition, presidential transition over here. It's going to be quite a long time before people are in place, and in the meantime, you'll get all of the fun and games and bureaucratic shenanigans, which people here are probably more familiar with than anywhere else in the world. So, What is interesting is how all of those issues and those events seem slightly beside the point at the moment. These are superstructural issues at a time where the structure of the European Union is changing and is under greater pressure than it has been probably in my lifetime. And that is the result of the financial crisis. I know you're going to have a proper discussion about that later, but it is worth thinking about what some of the possible scenarios could mean for the European Union as a partner to the US and as an actor on the world stage. So, you know, there are various different scenarios. I think the most likely scenario is that the European Union will muddle through with European leaders doing just enough to stop countries defaulting. But the cost of that will be, a return to the economics of the 1930s. The ECB is going to hang countries out on a Procrustean bed where they have really very deflationary policies, a lot of social unrest and a lot of unhappiness, which creates a very introverted and unhappy section of the European Union and massive tensions between countries that are focused on keeping inflation down and countries whose economies are shrinking. The second scenario which people talk about, which is probably slightly less likely, is a big leap forward to real political integration, which would lead to a real two-speed Europe, with the Eurozone moving forward with much greater fiscal consolidation and a lot of America's greatest allies being left in the slow lane in this two-speed Europe, Britain, Poland, other countries with whom you've enjoyed warm relationships will be passengers and spectators as the European Union gets built. The third outcome, which is also very plausible but probably slightly less likely, is that the euro breaks up into a northern and a southern euro, which would have a massive implication, massive effect on Europe's self-confidence, but also on the way that it's seen in the world, because the euro is starting to emerge into a potential tool of European power and could actually lead to the European Union playing a different sort of role in the world stage. So if the project collapses, that will have massive implications. But whichever of those scenarios comes to bear, what is clear is that they will make Europe more introverted, more focused on survival than on power projection, and a different kind of partner from the one that we envisaged when the Lisbon Treaty was signed. Which brings me to the third thing, which is the internal politics of the European Union. There's been a fair amount of attention on recent elections, the new coalition government in Britain, the national elections, and then the recent elections in North Rhine-Westphalia, Sarkozy's drubbing in the French elections. In the discussion afterwards, I could go into some of the details, but I think what is worth noting is what a lot of the governments in Europe actually have in common at the moment. Because I think you've got a new cohort of leaders who are very different from their counterparts that have four key characteristics. And I think the first is that this is the crisis generation. They're interested in geoeconomics and the shift of economic power rather than geopolitics and the balance of military power, where previous generations were defined by 1989, Kosovo, 9/11, or Iraq. This generation has been defined by the global economic crisis. Even those who were in power beforehand have been completely changed as a result of it. And what you can see through that is that they're less wedded to traditional geopolitical alliances with the US or enmities against Russia than their predecessors. They want to cut rather than increase military spending. They want to scale down involvement in far-off missions in Afghanistan. They want to return the problem of order to others, to local elites, to the US, to whoever can step in. And they're also increasingly happy to delegate classical foreign policy to their foreign ministers. They're not really seeking to make their reputation as foreign policy presidents or prime ministers. The second thing, I think, is a new geography within the European Union. The EU, to a very large extent for the last few years, was defined by Donald Rumsfeld's remark about the new and old Europe. He split Europe into east and western segments, and the key fault lines were geopolitical. In the geoeconomic world, the key fault lines are between north and south. And Ivan Krastev has pointed out very shrewdly that means that rather than Germany being the linchpin and the hinge between East and West, you have France that plays a similar role between North and South, and that creates a different geography within the European Union. The third fact is that this is a post-Lisbon generation. Today's leaders are focused on national concerns rather than European integration. They're neither particularly enthusiastic on deepening or widening the European Union. And the traditional ways that the European Union moved forward, whether it was through treaties, technocratic leadership by the European Commission, leadership by Germany and bankrolling by Germany, none of those are working in the way that they were beforehand. And finally, I think this is a post-American cohort. Today's leaders no longer look at the world exclusively through the prism of the transatlantic relationship. They're all, in their own ways, for their own personal reasons, pretty frustrated and feeling relatively unloved by the American president. And also, you know, structurally, they no longer particularly rely on the U.S. for physical protection, because it's not just that they're less concerned about security, but the Balkan wars were quite a long time ago. There aren't any kind of imminent threats for most European countries. Obviously, there are exceptions. If you sit in the Baltic states, you probably have a slightly different perspective. But that, I think, is the core sentiment in many different capitals, which also makes them more interested in emerging powers. Like everyone else, they're more interested in China and India than their predecessors were. So what does that mean for the transatlantic relationship? I think it means that we're going to enter into a new period of Atlanticism with three sort of core features. The first is an era of interest-based Atlanticism. I think these structural changes were going to work their way through the system sooner or later anyway. But Obama has accelerated them because he's not a reflexive Atlanticist, and that has forced Europeans actually to face up to the fact that we're in a different world, that the transatlantic relationship has a different sort of impact. And the fact that that the US has quite wisely decided to redistribute its own power away from the European continent to become a post-European power, to return more to a position of offshore balancing in the European continent, has also caused Europeans to rethink how they view their security and how that's kind of defended. And so I think, as Heather was saying, we're going to see a much more transactional transatlantic relationship. The era of kind of tides, I think, is over. You're not going to get Lithuanians serving in Afghanistan and weird places like that in the hope of strengthening Article 5 in the way that you were beforehand. A lot of European countries are going to withdraw from Afghanistan. The second kind of feature, I think, is you're going to need to think about new alliances. So, as I said before, your traditional friends, well, are maybe not so friendly anymore because they're some of the most frustrated countries with Obama, but also they're less important in the new Europe. But there are also new centres of power which could emerge and which could be very fruitful. I think that Hillary Clinton's developed a very good working relationship with Cathy Ashton. And as her role grows and as the European External Action Service takes shape and is able actually to make a real contribution in different places, that could be a very good symbiotic relationship where the European Union can deliver a lot. But equally, being an interlocutor to the State Department, at least, provide some external validation for her and for the institution that she's trying to build. And thirdly, I think related to that is the fact that it's probably going to be a more bottom-up relationship based on working together on the ground on different issues rather than a sort of top-down process led by summits, not least because the summits are likely to be cancelled. So I think it's a different kind of relationship. I'm not. I've run out of time, so I'm not going to go into any greater detail. But I would commend this report on called "Towards a Post-American Europe," which makes both the arguments about the structural changes much better than I did, but also looks at some of the features of the thing. I think Jeremy now has to disown his contribution to this, but Nick Whitney, the other author, still believes in what he wrote. I also think that. This isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think that I think people tend to underestimate the resilience of the European Union and the European project. That's why I think that my book is a bargain at $1 in California.
And we could probably
enrich
it for free here as well, even.
The price will definitely go up. No, I think that the European Union is very flexible and very resilient and is quite political and tends, a bit like the United States in Churchill's famous phrase, you know, to do the right thing in the end once it's exhausted all alternative options. But I also think that the transatlantic relationship could actually have a glorious new period ahead of it, because I think that it will now be shorn of illusions of some of the kind of angst and emotion which has characterized it in recent years. And Europeans and Americans are very similar. I've been very struck over the last few days at how immensely similar the mood is here to in European capitals. It's introverted, defensive, the kind of great hope which was there beforehand hasn't totally dissipated but isn't necessarily shining as kind of brightly as it was beforehand. And there's much more of a focus on interests and on American interests than there was beforehand. And that's pretty much a good description of the mood in most European capitals. So maybe we could see a glorious period of transatlantic compatibility together, where our ambitions are much lower than they were in previous periods of time, but we can work together in a practical way, trying to understand a world where we are no longer playing the sort of pivotal and the central role collectively that we were beforehand, and where we're having to navigate a new geography of power where different economic relationships are creating a whole world without the West, which is around us, which is threatening to undermine the liberal bias in the order which we've relied on so much over the last few years. And we might actually start to face up to it, because I think in recent years, Europeans and Americans have tended to underestimate the extent of those changes outside of our relationship, and have not developed the sort of strategies that we need to operate in a post-American world. And maybe that's something which we can now do together in this period of greater realism and where the audacity of hope has dimmed.
Well, that's a good slogan anyway. More glory and lower ambitions. That's one we can take away. Andres, how have things looked from the perspective of the Spanish presidency?
Thank you, Fiona. Thank you to the organizers, and thank you to Brookings for having this debate, which I think will be really useful. The title is a bit misleading, not because of what Heather was saying, but because I think we're not in the post-Lisbon era. We're in an era of transition to Lisbon, and we are in this process, and at the same time in the midst of the economic and financial crisis, and the two are linked unavoidably, and we will see how. Let me start that by saying that I think the European Union has gone through all the crises in history, economic and political. And every time European integration has advanced, it has never, since it started in 1950, gone backwards. Evidently, it could. But I think it's in the interest of the member countries not to do so. I don't have to remind the audience that the letter and the spirit of the Lisbon Treaty amount to a turning point in the Union external ambitions, backed by a series of tools and capacities. The President of the European Council, which I think is an important institution, even more important in some ways than the High Representative, no? Which reinforces the external way the EU is going to work, plus the European External Action Service under construction, variable geometry for defense, solidarity clauses within the European Union, which I think are all important. Spain, for his presidency, had to work hard during the year before making a double planning, because we were not sure that the Lisbon Treaty was going to come into force. Mm-hmm. So we had to make the planning on the next treaty, which means a traditional transition presidency. and then on the Lisbon Treaty. No? The experience that we had is that it's not working that badly for the moment. No, there are tensions, not so much between the presidency and the new institutions, but among the new institutions and the Commission, which I think will be solved with time. For Spain, I think one of the or the three main aims of this presidency were three. One was to put into place the Lisbon Treaty. We are succeeding in that. That would not be very sexy or very appealing, but I think that would be one of the legacy. The second is when we started talking about that before the early next year, is to build an economic governance for the European Union. And that was before the height of the present crisis. This is going to happen, as I will say later. And then the third one is to try to have an agreement on Europe 2020, which is an outlook for on how to make Europe grow again. And if we don't grow, it really will begin to become irrelevant, or we at best will become a good museum for the rest of the world. If all these things works, I think the EU would be a good partner for the US, not only with bilateral affairs, but especially to work together on joint approaches to international challenges and crises and to the management of globalization and to global affairs. We are not talking here just about foreign policy, but also about economic policy. And I see in the new national security strategy of the US that the economy is the first priority, which is significant. We are seeing that we are advancing decisively to an economic governance of the EU, and in particular of the members of the euro. Some months ago, when we were preparing this presidency, to talk about economic governance, not to talk about economic government of Europe, was something which was almost forbidden. It was not accepted by many. We were talking about sanctions for people who were not complaining, for countries which were not complaining with the main provisions, and now that's what's on the table. As the report on Project Europe 2030, which was headed by Felipe González, says, the crisis has acted as a wake-up call for Europe to respond to the changing global order. What was unthinkable some months ago is becoming a reality, even though there are some unthinkables creeping in. Some months ago, I think it would have been unthinkable that the European Union put together a package of $750 billion to rescue member countries of the euro. I hope we will not need it, but I think it's a show of not of solidarity, but of rationality and of help to the countries which might need it. No? This would have made the present situation would have made a US-European summit really interesting, because I think that the Obama administration is interested in what's happening in the economic field in Europe, not least because it's affected by it, by the value of the dollar and by the perspectives for the payment of the US sovereign debt. I think it's a bit late to do all this, but it's not too late. It's late because some of the fathers of all this European Union or the Monetary Union already had pointed out to the problems that we were going to have. I don't think it's too late because I think Germany has changed. It has gone... It would have been better to have done it 3 or 4 months ago, but we're still on time. No? The setting down of these figures, of all this, will take time, and it will make transatlantic relations more complex. We have seen it with the SWIFT issue, which has proved also that we have to look at the European Parliament, or the Americans have to look at the European Parliament as much as we look at the Congress, which is an added difficulty, or not difficulty, I would say an added complexity to the institutional relations between the EU and the US. What I think the Lisbon Treaty means, or one of the effects it's having, is that for institutional reasons, is that the foreign ministries are losing their weight in the European construction. Now we see that it's the economic ministers, the home affairs ministers, the justice ministers, who have more to say about the way the European Union is advancing. That runs the risk of a temptation to renationalize foreign policy in the European Union, a risk which has happened already in the years between the approval of the European Constitution and the failure of it, and the entry into force of the Lisbon Treaty. Renationalization, which hasn't had too much practical success, I may add, no? Not only for the small countries, but for all the countries. I think now in Europe, all countries are small for the multipolar world to which we're going, even Germany or France. No? So with time, the choice will be more integration in foreign policy or irrelevance. The problem is that at present, nobody speaks now in the name of Europe and of the European interests. What do I think is my main worry at the moment is that it's a danger of a double retrenchment, driven mainly by economic consideration, but also by political ones, in terms of efforts of peace and aid, on the US on the one hand and of the European on the others. If the Americans and the Europeans both enter a period in which managing their internal problems become more pressing than managing the global ones, then other powers will have enhanced windows of opportunities to redefine their global and regional balances. And this could lead to a Western retrenchment that could add to the natural demographic and economic weakening of the West in relative terms. This has to do with values, and not only with values, but with the economic models that we're defending, when there are other models in the world which are more successful, which produce more growth, and which fulfill more the interests of the people. No? Another factor which I think is going to be difficult to understand for the US is that the common foreign policy of the EU is not a single policy, and is not going to be a single policy for the time being. It might become one in the next few years or few decades, but not for the moment. It could help if the EU at least spoke with one voice, and even better, with one mouth, as didn't happen in Copenhagen. No? But I think there are progresses in the way the European Union is dealing with some of the things which are happening, especially in its neighborhood, which we will talk in the second panel. One of these attitudes, of the new kind of attitudes, has been the change in Poland and Russia, especially after the Katyn accident. No? We have to push for common ground on all these issues, and also on common ground with the US. But as the report on a new approach for Euro-American partnership by the North Europe, the foundation set up by Jacques Delors, says, the unity of Europe is a necessary condition for the influence of the Union, but it has become an insufficient condition. It needs the culture and it needs the tools. There has to be a unity in aims, in interests, and of instruments, and this, I think, will take time. In a multipolar world, the aim for Europe and the challenge is to become one of the poles and to push for multilateralism. We have no choice but to be multilaterals. And there, I think the U.S. has a different view. It's pushing for multi-partnership, which is not necessarily lead to multilateralism, but to what I call multi-bilateralism. The U.S., though, is still an indispensable nation for Europe, but not for European integration, but for things which happen outside of the transatlantic relations and which affect us all. I don't think the EU needs any more what General de Gaulle called an agent fédérateur externe, which was America. I think Europe has ceased to be a strategic problem for the U.S., but these days we see that it's becoming an economic problem that affects the U.S. We shouldn't be worried too worried that the U.S. is looking for two other partners, but that Europe remains one of the major partners of the U.S. The Europe-American partnership is necessary to manage present crisis and to be able to elaborate and propose global solutions to global problems. We have to work on the role of NATO, which is an alliance that has lost its centrality but not its importance, and we have to work on the relations between NATO and the EU. But today, I think transatlantic relations are about other things. Transatlantic has to include Africa, has to include Latin America, which I think are important areas in what is called the Atlantic Basin Initiative, to which we should give more importance and more weight. Then there is a shaping of globalization that needs Western input. What kind of globalization do we want between the U.S. and Europe? We have to push for common goods, but also fight against common bads. And security itself is a common good. Let's shape, my proposal would be to shape a radical agenda 2020 for the U.S. and Europe for transatlantic relations, in which we would talk about things which will happen in the next 10 years and try to avoid the immediate solutions to irritants. Look at 2020, which will help to solve the problems of our relations, for example, on Iran. Not really the immediate response to sanctions, but a 5 to 10 years process on key issues of how the region is going to look like. I think in transatlantic relations at the moment there is a real lack of anticipation of the world to come. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Jeremy.
Thanks. It's good to be back here at Brookings. It's good to see old friends. It's good to have an opportunity to, as a sort of new government official, to repudiate publicly all the things I supposedly held while I worked here. I think along those lines, I'd say my central point today is that the United States wants to work with a strong, cohesive Europe as a partner in meeting today's economic and security problems. There is really no ambivalence, which has existed in this town in the past, in the Obama administration on this point, and no fear of a united Europe. And in fact, to the contrary, our fear these days is very much of a, as has been mentioned by I think all the panelists, of a weak and inward-focused Europe. And partially as a result of this view, I think we have seen in the first year and a half of the Obama administration an extraordinarily high, I would say even unprecedented, level of unity and common purpose between the United States and Europe as they've sort of worked together to try to deal with gathering and current global problems and threats on Iran, on Iraq, on Afghanistan, on climate change, on Guantanamo, on the Balkans, you name it. I've been working on these issues for a long time. And my sense is that there hasn't been a time since I've been working on it, where our global strategies with Europeans are as in sync as they are today. That is by no means to say that we don't have differences. We certainly do. And it's certainly not saying that we are together solving all of the world's problems. We certainly are not. it is to say that on the big issues of the day, we're working very well together. Now, I know that some have suggested, I think even on this panel, that the centrality of the transatlantic relationship is diminished as a result of the many daunting global challenges that the United States is facing and the approach the United States has taken to them, particularly the rise of new powers. The logic seems to be that because the United States is so preoccupied and apparently preoccupied with Iraq, with Afghanistan, with Iran, et cetera, that we need Europe less or we pay less attention to Europe. I think that this view is quite mistaken. And in fact, I think the opposite is true. It's precisely because we are faced with such a daunting array of global problems that we need the cooperation of our oldest, most like-minded, and most effective allies to the extent that we do, and we find them in Europe. On all the issues I mentioned, certainly, we look first to our European partners to develop common policies and for advice, for assistance, for solidarity. There is a general recognition in the Obama administration that none of these important problems can be solved or even really managed without effective U.S.-European cooperation. That's sort of an article of faith. I would add that I see the same view in Europe. Mark was citing the report that we wrote last year. The report was hortatory, I think, and it was pushing Europeans toward adopting this point of view. The research on this report actually implied quite the opposite. It implied that Europeans, in fact, don't see the world this way. They don't see the world as a place where they can operate independently. They see the world very much as a place where they need, and this applies not just to Eastern Europeans, but to all of the Europeans, where they very much need tight, effective cooperation with the United States. And so it's a parallel process. One can see this type of process unfolding right now, just to sort of pick one kind of small example in the grand scheme of things, I guess, on the issue of conventional arms control in Europe. A lot of people, analysts, officials on both sides of the Atlantic and in Russia have raised the problem of the sort of fraying conventional arms control regime in Europe. So the Secretary of State appointed a special envoy for this problem, the former NATO ambassador, Torja Nuland. And she, as her sort of first act as this new special envoy, embarked on a prolonged, listening tour is the best way to describe it. She's going out to all of the European allies and talking to them about what they need and want out of the conventional arms control regime. I got a call just the other day from an official of an unnamed country who said to me, what was Torja Nuland doing here? And I said, well, she came to talk to you about conventional arms control. And he said, yes, but what do you want us to do? And I said, well, she's here to consult. That's what consultations are like. She listens to what you say and takes that on board and tries to come up with a common position. And he said, oh, that's a bit frightening. Are you sure you don't have any ideas that you just want to let us know about right now? So this is an uncomfortable proposition. We shouldn't underestimate just how difficult it is to work and to develop joint partnerships. We have an idea on the conventional arms control. That's why we appointed a special envoy, that we need to lead, that we need to formulate to crystallize the alliance opinion, but we don't need to hand it to the alliance, and we're asking for consultations. And besides from this guy, I think we're getting them. And I would say it is precisely because we know we need a strong European partner, and this is the other point I really want to stress, that we welcome the Lisbon Treaty. The treaty marks a really, I think, important, as everybody has said, milestone for Europe and for its role in the world. It creates new institutions, such as the European Council Presidency, the High Representative, the External Action Service. and an empowered European Parliament that's going to guide the future of the European Union, hopefully to a more coherent and consistent and, we hope, effective foreign policy. And because we were very supportive of that goal, we were very quick off the mark to engage with these new institutions, and High Representative Ashton took her first extra EU trip here to meet the Secretary of State. And they've already established, as I think Mark mentioned, a very close and effective working relationship. This transition has not always been easy for Europeans as well as for Americans. It's sometimes been very difficult to navigate the new and uncertain institutional configuration. Heather challenged us to find 10 people in Washington who understood how Brussels works. I would challenge her to find 10 people in Brussels who understand how Brussels works. It's very confusing. We have had, for example, a struggle getting to approval of the terrorist finance tracking program, though we are, I think, optimistic at this point that it's going to move forward. But the larger point is that the relationship is healthy enough to contain these types of disputes, and we look forward to engaging with these new institutions. The Parliament, I guess like all legislative branches, and we're quite used to this, is a pain. That's the nature of executive-legislative interaction. Interestingly, this is something that the U.S. government is a lot more used to than the European governments. And if you go to the European Parliament, they're very interested in asserting their prerogatives. They're very interested in having both the United States and the member states and the other European institutions pay more attention to them. So I don't want to exaggerate this point. But they do mention that the United States seems to have a better handle on how to deal with a newly assertive parliament than their own member states, and particularly than the European Council. Because, you know, we understand what these legislatures need. We understand that they're a necessary and healthy part of a democracy, and that they ultimately lend themselves to create a popular base for foreign policy, which is what's necessary to make it more effective. So, you know, we go through the pain. I should say also that we understand, as Andres mentioned, that the Lisbon Treaty will take time to have its effects, and that it is early days. We, after all, just took over a year to transition to a new U.S. government. In point of fact, we're not actually done. And we weren't even really creating any new institutions. The EU's transition is certainly not done, and in fact, I think it's fair to say it has barely begun. The External Action Service has not even been stood up yet. Having said that, we have some concerns. I have some concerns about the signs coming from Brussels that the post-Lisbon EU may not live up to its potential of delivering a more coherent EU policy. The EU seems to be having more than the usual amount of trouble managing crises, more than the usual amount of trouble establishing what roles the various institutions will have, and perhaps more fundamentally, deciding just how integrated and centralized or joint or common or whatever word you want to use, a foreign policy that the member states really want. The U.S. does not really have a role in this debate. I agree with Andres that we are not a motor for European integration anymore, and we can hardly be more integrationist than the Europeans. But we do have a stake in the outcome. The United States, and I would argue the world, needs an EU that can support the interests and values of Europe around the world, that remains outwardly focused, and that can assume its rightful place in global affairs, in partnership with the United States, but also in partnership with other nations. We understand that for Europe, particularly at this difficult moment of financial stress, this represents a very significant challenge. What I would say, as I sort of survey the landscape of my inbox, the problems of the day really demand that they rise to the challenge, and we're there to assist, but I think we could ultimately it is a challenge for Europe. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jeremy. It's taken us a lot longer, I guess, than we'd anticipated to explain all of these various issues. I would encourage people to go and grab coffee as we continue with the discussions, because what we were going to try to do is not have a proper break, really, in between panels. We're going to do a quick changeover, which will clearly be seamless, but as you know, like all transitions, it might take a little bit of time. That's certainly been the theme of our discussions today. In any case, I mean, there are a lot of people in the audience. I can see at least a handful of people who know what's going on in Brussels. I can see a few people who are actually from Brussels in this audience, and I'm sure that they may have a few comments as well as questions here. But I'd like to, we have a microphone that's going to move around, and I'd like to encourage people here to offer some observations and also some questions. Question here and then over here, so we'll take two together. Thank you, and please identify yourself for the panelists. Thank you.
Manuel Lafont-Apnouy, I'm a visiting fellow at CSIS. I wanted to follow up on Jeremy's comment about the fact that there is no more U.S. ambivalence toward Europe, that what the U.S. wants is a strong, cohesive Europe, but is it so just because the moment right now is more of a risk of a weak Europe, or is it totally unlinked with that risk? And to dig into that, I'm not challenging the idea that there's a centrality for the US of partnering with Europe, but I'm challenging the idea that Europe would be the first stop for any U.S. initiative or program or priority in the international scene. It actually, sometimes, it does look like it's the last stop because it's taken for granted. It's the last stop not because it's not important. It's important, but it's taken for granted, which makes it at least look sensible to first consult with others, with the emerging powers, with the less like-minded partners, to agree upon some kind of terms of references, and then you go and you rubber stamp these terms of references with the Europeans. And so what you want is a Europe that is easy and comfortable enough to partner with you, to bring something on the table, but actually it's comfortable for the US on a strictly objective point of view to have not a Europe that is not too strong and too cohesive. Thank you.
Thank you. Over here, and then over here, the gentleman in the blue shirt, and then there's a lady at the back with a yellow shirt on.
We'll Tony Smith, the French American Foundation. We didn't rehearse this question, but it's along the same lines, and it's for all the members of the panel, but I guess mainly for Jeremy Shapiro. Inevitably, in conferences like this, one hears that Europe is no longer loved by the United States, that it's not central to the United States anymore, that Obama's from Hawaii and Indonesia and he doesn't understand Europe, and on and on, and that this has consequences. It has consequences that will reframe how we operate with Europe. It's going to be transactional. There's not going to be any more Lithuanians going to Afghanistan. It's going to be a bottoms-up kind of on-the-ground cooperation. And then one hears from the United States representative says, no, that's all wrong. Europe is still central, and we want a strong Europe, and this is the first time that we haven't been ambivalent about this and so forth. Now, obviously, there is a distinctly different view held on the two sides of the Atlantic on this issue. So my question really is this. Is it important that we have this dichotomy in viewpoints about whether or not Europe is central to America's focus these days? If not, why is it not important? And if it is important, what are you doing about it?
Very good, thanks. And then over to the back, here, Perry, right next to you. Right there, yeah, thanks.
Thank you. I'm Sally McNamara from the Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom at the Heritage Foundation. I have two very brief questions. Our Spanish friend mentioned Jacques Delors, and I was very happy to hear that. Of course, Jacques Delors was the guy who said we have to develop the EU in secret because if the public knew what we were doing, they would never support us. I wonder if you have any concerns about the lack of public legitimacy and support for further European integration. Of course, the Lisbon Treaty was rejected 3 times in referenda, and the EU says, go back and vote again until we get the right answer. We've seen people in Germany, an overwhelming amount of whom would have the Deutschmark back rather than the euro. even the Liberal Democrats in the UK cabinet have accepted that there can't be any further integration that the British will sign up to because we're deeply uncomfortable with our relationship with the European Union. Are you not worried about the lack of public support? Because there's only so far you can go before this whole thing blows up. My second question is about the Lisbon Treaty and the foreign policy provisions. I wonder exactly what crisis you think the Lisbon Treaty can address, whether it's something like Haiti in the future or Iran, whatever it might be. I've been a European analyst for over a decade now, and I've constantly heard about how Maastricht and Amsterdam and Nice is going to stop the EU being impotent before a crisis again. And of course, the next time the EU fails, it says we need another treaty to do it better next time, and they never actually managed to do this. So I wonder exactly what foreign policy crisis the Lisbon Treaty will help the EU address.
Thanks. Well, I guess those are all related. I'll take some more questions after this and let the panel begin. Jeremy, there was a number of issues pointedly directed at you.
Thanks.
But then I'll ask the rest of the panel to comment on the other, particularly of Sally's very forceful sort of questions there about the, I shouldn't really say that word on the stage, but the impotence of the EU here and whether treaties can work like little blue pills, I guess, is really the kind of question here.
You want me to follow that up?
No, Jeremy, it's all right. The U.S. isn't in the pill-dispensing mode, I presume, anyway.
One of the peculiarities I've discovered of being a government official is that you come to conferences and people say to you, why isn't the U.S. government paying attention to the following thing? And you think to yourself, that's strange. I spend 80 hours a week on it. I suppose when I sort of try to puzzle through this, why they aren't noticing how I spend my time, I think, well, maybe they mean that we're not being effective, which is sometimes true, but that's not what they're saying. And sometimes I think, well, maybe what they mean is that we're not getting a lot of high level attention on the issue, which is sometimes true of the issues that I spend 80 hours a week on, and I think that's because I work so well on them that they don't require high-level attention. And that's a really important point about the function of the U.S.-European relationship, is that it is so dense and so institutionalized that, in fact, it works very, very well at sort of lower levels, which pass under the radar. I have a colleague who works in the Near Eastern Bureau of the State Department, and she recently went to a meeting, a U.S.-European meeting on Middle East issues. And she came back from that meeting and she said, you guys have a very different diplomacy than we do. We go into a meeting with the Middle Easterners and we sit on both sides of the table and we yell at each other about how stupid we are. In the European diplomacy, you actually discuss how you can work together to solve the problems, and it's much more cooperative. And this, and not to say that there aren't differences, but it's an entirely different type of conversation at the working level. This sort of expresses the way I used to put it, that it may be true that Americans are from Mars and Europeans are from Venus, but if that's true, the Chinese are from Alpha Centauri. And that sometimes this feels a little bit like the narcissism of small differences. So to try to bring that back to the questions, Manuel is asking why we favor a strong Europe. We don't do that out of the goodness of our heart. It has a sort of Cartesian attraction to it, but that's not the reason. But the reason also is not because Europe is weak. The reason is, as I said, because the global problems are daunting, and we understand that we will not solve them without an effective Europe. Is that selfish? I don't know. Maybe it is. I don't care. I think that's a pretty good reason to feel that way. The question of whether we go to Europe first or last or in the between, I think sort of misunderstands the very deep interinstitutional ties that I was talking about. When you go to China, you have to bring a very sort of, you have to bring 200 officials at a very high level and have a very complicated protocol-laden interaction. When you go to Europe, which we do every day, in fact, those consultations are taking place constantly. And in fact, we are doing this stuff on a daily basis. And so on every issue, I would say, even on issues which don't terribly well concern Europe, we do turn to them first. That may not make the media. And I think that this is part of the problem, is that we assume that what defines the attention of government officials is what we see in the media. And what do we see in the media? We see places where we disagree and don't work together because those are the interesting stories. And so we talk a lot about Iran in the media because it's and the U.S. seems very focused on Iran. But the European Bureau and the State Department generates 80% of the paper. I'm not really sure whether that's a good thing or not, or even, frankly, what that means. But it does mean that we are a lot busier than others. But that, I think, gets to Tony's question, whether it was, does this dichotomy matter? Because I think he's absolutely right that the perception is out there, I guess in part for the reasons I said. And, you know, I think it does matter. We the basis of this relationship has to be a strong sense that we need to work together and that we are working together. What to do about it, I'm not entirely sure. I know that, you know, you're never going to have a New York Times headline story that says, you know, Deputy Assistant Secretary of State meets European counterpart for 11th time. I think, you know, I come to conferences like this and I say this over and over again, and maybe eventually it'll work.
Andres, Sally asked a few questions about treaties. We don't have to quite respond to them in the way that I summarized that up. But, I mean, do you feel that the Lisbon Treaty has made the EU any better position to deal with crises? I mean, Haiti would be a difficult crisis for the EU, given the distance to respond to, but Iran is a clear crisis that the European Union is in the midst of. Do you think that the Lisbon Treaty has helped more than Maastricht or other treaties before?
Yes, I think the Lisbon Treaty will help with time the European Union to deal with crises. But it's not just a matter of treaties. It's a matter of political will and of capabilities. And in terms of capabilities, I think we are far behind where we should. We have, I think, about, for example, in terms of soldiers, we have about 500,000 more soldiers than the U.S., but we are unable to put a force of 60,000 people on the ground. And that applies also to civilian capabilities, which are very important for the European Union. What I think is that in the question that was made before, is that, yes, there is a lack of public legitimacy, but which should be solved through through referenda. Mm-hmm. I don't believe much in referenda because people tend to vote on things which have nothing to do with the question, but more on the mood of the moment. And it would be impossible to govern a change of treaties in a European Union with 27 members with 27 referenda. No? Mm. Maybe if you had a referendum at the European level, that could work. What's happening, I think, is that there is a change of mood in some countries, and especially in one, which I think worries me. I saw a recent poll in which people from the main European countries were asked, do you think the European integration has gone too far, not far enough, or enough? And two countries answered that it had gone too far, over 40%, 42% in the case of Britain, which is not that surprising. But 41% in the case of Germany, which is something which didn't happen 10 years ago. And I think that has happened because maybe because of many reasons. But one reason is that I think the elite and the people who are at the head of the elites are not talking and not doing any pedagogical work in terms of Europe and what Europe means for Germany. Yeah?
Mm.
And that happened all over the place in Europe. I think we lack figures of the kind of Jacques Delors who embodied a vision of Europe.
What do you think about that, Mark, particularly about the national mood and the public legitimacy issues that Sally raised?
Can I answer the other question
first?
You
can answer another question as well, yeah.
Okay. No, because I think on the public legitimacy, I'll deal with that very briefly. I think that there are legitimacy problems, but they are often confused with the idea that there's a democratic deficit. See Andy Moravchik at the back of the room, and I think he's written very convincingly that I don't know if he'd frame it in this way, but that actually the main problem with this is a category mistake. It's that we try and use the wrong tools to get legitimacy for what's going on. The problem for European Union is not a democratic deficit. If anything, it's a democratic surplus, because we force technical things, which aren't the sort of things which people get very excited in, into an elected, into it, we use the wrong kind of tools to. Andy's shown that there's much greater checks and balances within the European political system than in almost any national system. But the things that we're dealing with aren't the same things that you deal with in a national system. So when people get involved in politics at a national level, it's largely about the delivery of public services, it's about the strength of the economy, it's about pensions and schools and hospitals and wars. And the European Union has a lot of power, but it's in the parts of, but it's in areas which people don't really care about and didn't care about when they were governed by national bureaucrats. And they've now been brought up to a kind of higher level, but it's quite difficult to get people excited about the sound emissions of lawnmower regulations and other sorts of things like that, which is why they don't necessarily show up to vote in European elections. If you have a referendum on technical treaties, which are about process rather than about substance, it's quite difficult to fill the space, so you tend to have very low turnout, and you often have a referendum which is largely an attempt to take the temperature of people's support for the incumbents rather than it being about the issues concerned, because they're not really the right sort of issues for these sorts of things. But anyway, these are slightly theoretical points, because I don't think there are going to be any more treaties or referenda for a very long time, because I think Lisbon does at least mark the high watermark of European integration for the next kind of stretch of time. But the question I really wanted to answer was about, the transatlantic relationship. Does it matter more? Is there a big divide? I mean, I don't think there is a divide on both sides of the Atlantic. I think that basically the problem the basic thing which we're dealing with is that 20 years ago the Cold War came to an end, which means that Europe no longer needs the US for its protection in the way that it did before. It's now united, it's kind of fixed, it's not a massive security problem for Americans. That's opened the door for globalization and for other powers to emerge and to join the global economy. There's been a massive shift in economic power, which has created shifts in military and political power, which has allowed our values and our way of looking at things to be challenged by people with other ideas about what's going on. And if you take all of those things together, it means that the transatlantic relationship isn't the right unit of analysis for most of the problems that we're trying to think about in the world. If you want to come up with a solution on climate change, sure, we're big emitters, but there is an even bigger emitter than any European country or the US, which is China. If you want to deal with Iran, there are other countries that have vetoes on the... If sanctions is your particular way of dealing with it, there are other countries that have vetoes, so it doesn't matter if we necessarily agree with each other. And those countries tend to buy more things from the Iranians and invest more in their oil fields. If you're trying to deal with Afghanistan or Pakistan, again... there are other people who've got more influence than Europeans, such as Afghanistan's neighbours. Therefore, the transatlantic relationship, whilst heavily institutionalised and close and easy in the way that Jeremy described, is a small part of a bigger picture on almost any issue you're talking about. And that's not... a function of Obama being born in Hawaii or anything like that. It's just a fact. It's a structural change in the world. And that's why we need to rethink how we go about doing things in the world. And that's where we're at the moment. But it's not going to change as a result of pointing out how many times Obama goes to Europe or how many hours a week Jeremy spends on the transatlantic relationship. These are, I think, more structural.
I'm with you on the first of those.
It was.
Yeah, it was impressive, however. We'll give Jeremy that. Heather, you want a quick comment, and then I'll just take two more questions from the floor, and we'll do our transition to the next panel.
Absolutely. Focusing in on sort of the long-term sustainability of the relationship, what concerns me about the U.S.-EU transatlantic relationship writ large is the prolonged period where our agendas don't match. And you can sustain that for a while, but if you don't come to a point where agendas start looking together, where, yes, there's one party has a priority, the other party, and there's not some mutual benefit to a shared agenda, I think you have the makings of a long-term problem. And the American and European agendas haven't matched for a while. And I use Afghanistan as sort of my example, is where as a top priority of the administration, understandably. And after 9 years of shared challenge in Afghanistan, you speak to many Europeans and you ask them, why are you in Afghanistan? And they look at you and they say, well, for you, for the relationship. Some have motivations of an Article 5, if the Lithuanian example, if we're in Afghanistan, perhaps that will cause the United States to be much more forthcoming in their engagement within NATO. But it's not necessarily the same reason why the United States is in Afghanistan. And you can sustain that for a while, that difference, but when the challenges are great, and that's when frictions cause, because our motivations are very different. Jeremy, I'm going to challenge you on sort of the quantity versus quality of the dialogue and the conversation. And this gets back to my point of cultivation, and I want to pull that out of the national security strategy, because I think cultivation of allies are critical, and the content of the conversation and the dialogue. It is not the frequency. It is not the ritualization of the process. It's the quality by which you talk. And we can allow the U.S.-EU relationship, the quality can be about poultry washing. That's up to us. If we want to sort of allow that to be a dominant conversation around the U.S.-EU table. Or we can be strategic, we can think long and hard, and we can enhance the quality. If your colleague, Jeremy, that you talked to didn't understand why Ambassador Newland was visiting and what the purpose was, then that's quantity. She went, she listened, but that's not quality. And both sides probably left that meeting going, what was that? That's what we have to prevent. That's why we have to go back to this cultivation. It is hard work. Europe is hard, hard work. It's complex. You hear differences of opinion. You may hear one voice from Brussels. You hear another voice from the Capitol. Well, you know what? When any European visits Washington and they go to the Defense Department, the State Department, the National Security Council, various agencies, I guarantee you they will hear complexity. They will hear different voices. We're both hard. We're hard partners. We're hard friends to have. But I think we've always historically believed the value of the relationship is greater to overcome the frustrations. And I'm starting to be concerned that calculation is being transformed. The frustrations now are almost not worth the effort for both sides. This is not just one direction. And last point to Sally's question. I think the EU process has always been about, it's been an elite exercise. But let's not lose the fact that the EU touches every citizen, whether you stand in line at the airport or a regulatory process, it touches. It is powerful. You know, students are studying in Europe because Erasmus, they're not coming to the U.S. for costs and things like that. It's powerful. And getting back to my question, that's why we have to focus on quality, because we're never going to meet the quantity that is within the EU system. And that's, we're not competing, but we have to focus on the quality. And I think we've fallen a little behind, but to Jeremy's point, we're the administration is still getting up to full speed, and the challenges are great, but we've got to transform how we do this. It's not shooting into an economic council or an energy council. It's getting to the strategic level.
Because we've got limited time, I'm just going to ask the three people who still wanted to ask questions, who are all nicely, conveniently clustered together. The gentleman here, the purple shirt, Paul Sharp here in the white shirt, and the gentleman here with the very nice pink tie. And then we'll move on very quickly into the next panel, please.
Thank you. I'm Anthony Odi. I'm a consultant on development issues. Maybe my attention drifted for a few seconds, but I don't think I heard any of the speakers really dwell on the fact there's been a change of power in the UK to a government led by a party which, at least in opposition, did a great deal to advertise its Euroscepticism. Perhaps this means that pragmatically you don't think this will make much difference. Perhaps it's because with this very strange coalition you think it's too soon to tell.
Thanks. Very nice, succinct question. Here and then in the white shirt behind, yeah.
Jeff Stacey from the State Department. Until Heather just mentioned Afghanistan, I was about to say I was curious as to why Afghanistan wasn't mentioned yet today by this panel. For all the obvious reasons, certainly NATO relations have been colored in every way by what's happened in Afghanistan, and it's been very challenging. But I don't know how many of you in this room saw Richard Haass's article in the FT the other day or the other week. Could be summed up in one phrase, U.S. no longer needs Europe. But as you've heard Jeremy say, and you won't be surprised to hear me say, the Department of State doesn't have that view. And although that article and others seem to be consistent with this new conventional wisdom that we are at present in the nadir of U.S.-EU relations, I concur that we stand together on a huge array of matters. But there is sort of one curious thing that I might say to European friends. In lots and lots of meetings in recent months and in years, we are welcomed, you might say, by our European colleagues back to, might use the metaphor of the table. Their view is that we've been away from the table for some time, but now we're back. But we would expect to sort of participate in the conversation and have the meal together, but in fact, it seems like all too often we're expected to sort of sit quietly for a while and sort of wondering when we're going to move past that. But I agree with Mr. Ortega that indeed Lisbon's promise is great, and I work for the coordinator for reconstruction and stabilization at state, what the UN calls peace building, what the EU calls civilian crisis management, and we are engaging each other very readily. As the EU is building hard power tools, like the EU battle groups, we're building soft power tools. There's a great deal seemingly to work together on. I've been very impressed with Fran Gerber and Dan Hamilton's initiative, among others. And so I'd like to ask the panelists, what big issue could be picked where there might be a union across the Atlantic where the two sides could stand together and make a real difference? Might that be related to the international financial architecture? Sarkozy and Brown and others, it's really been the Europeans that have done the most creative thinking on this. They've called for Bretton Woods II. Maybe we need a Basel III. Maybe we need some sort of combination of the two. I just wonder what you think.
Thanks a lot. And then Paul Sharp is just behind you here in the white shirt. Thanks.
Paul Adamson.
Paul Adamson. I'm thinking about E. Sharp. In fact, I should actually say that if people didn't get their copies, Paul Adamson, who is the publisher of E. Sharp, is turning him into his publication, which was outside available, which will tell you all you need to know about Brussels, right?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Very early on, Heather, you mentioned that the commonly held view that US or Obama rebuffed Europe by not going to this US summit. If it was a rebuff, I would argue it was a rebuff to the Spanish government. Because it's supposed to be in Madrid, of course. So the logic of Lisbon, as you know, was that all these what's called third country bilateral summits should no longer take place in member state capitals, but actually in Brussels, if at all. And frankly, the Spanish government was the most embarrassed because they exploited, I would argue, Mr. Ortega, their presidency for their own personal national interests as opposed to the EU interest. And they were rebuffed, and I would argue rightly so. It wasn't a rebuff by the US. It was, maybe the US is trying to, maybe it's Jeremy Shapiro's influence on Obama, the White House. that the Europeans, the logic of Lisbon is that we don't do these summits anymore in member state capitals. Let's be clear about that. And Mark also mentioned that it may be more bottom-up than top-down. I'd argue both. You also mentioned, Mark, that Kathy and Hillary Clinton have this relationship. It's clear. And they talk a lot, clearly, and email a lot to each other. So I think it's going to be both bottom-up and top-down going forward. And one reason why Cathy Ashton, why the External Action Service had such difficulty getting credibility is because it had a very bad European media in the past few weeks, because European politicians and European diplomats and other people like that have been briefing Cathy Ashton personally and the whole idea of a high rep foreign policy against in the media, and that's why things have been going so badly wrong in the past few weeks. I think Europeans are finally working up the fact that this is counterproductive, but not a word has come in this kind of critical nature from the US side, to their great credit. And I would simply suggest, in summing up, that the issue at the moment is not that the US not taking Europe seriously, it's Europe not taking Europe seriously.
Thanks very much. And these, I'll just actually ask our panelists to try to give a quick response to this. In response to Jeff Searcy about Afghanistan, you'll be pleased to know that yesterday in the workshop that we had together with all the panelists, Afghanistan was actually a central theme of the discussions that we had with our US and European counterparts. And we had numerous people also from the State Department working directly on the Afghanistan issue. And there was a very serious discussion about this, which was pretty much along the lines that you outlined about the US and Europe both acknowledging the necessity of cooperating together, but of course raising all of the longer-term challenges and some of the difficulties of sustaining the momentum in Afghanistan, as Heather touched upon. So perhaps we won't touch on the Afghanistan issue. We can tell you a little bit more about that afterwards. But I'll ask everyone to quickly touch on the other issues. Perhaps, Mark, you could start with the UK perspective, and then let's see if we have any suggestions on what a big issue that the EU and the US could work together on.
Well, it's still very early days for this government, but I wouldn't expect a massive change to British foreign or European policy as a result of it, for a number of reasons. First of all, because it is a coalition government, and one of the big advantages for David Cameron about being in a coalition government is that he was going to end up in fulfilling all of his worst nightmares. I think all politicians are affected by formative experiences, and his formative experiences were watching the Conservative Party rip itself apart over Europe and over Maastricht, because it had a tiny majority which then disappeared. And that was about to happen to him, because if he'd won the election, he would have had a tiny majority which would have disappeared, and there are enough head-banging Eurosceptics in the party to make it more or less ungovernable, I think, on many foreign policy issues. However, as there's a coalition, it both allows him to shed the sillier ideas in their manifesto about repatriating powers, and also gives him a cushion of a decent cushion in order to make sure that there is a kind of majority there. Secondly, because actually, you know, Britain, after a brief period of activist and engaged European behaviour under Tony Blair, went back to its kind of status quo ante, which is essentially being kind of negative foot dragging, but not enough to actually get anything done under Gordon Brown. And I think that's more or less going to sort of continue for the next period of time. Thirdly, because there isn't, because Britain isn't actually in the bits of the European Union which are going to have to really change very dramatically over the next period of time. If Britain was in the euro, it could actually have a much more important impact on the existential decisions which are going to be made over the next few months. Because Britain isn't in the euro, that's not going to happen. And fourthly, because of what I sort of described earlier, the mood in other capitals actually is not that different from the mood in London. So there aren't any great European projects being hatched up in Berlin or Paris or other capitals. What you have is a very different sort of atmosphere. And actually, you've got as much Euroscepticism in some of the kind of core European countries like Germany as you have in Britain. So I don't think that that Britain's particularly out of sync with the European norm. So for all those reasons, I don't think it's going to have a massive impact. I do think it does have an impact for the US, though, because it does mean that the special relationship is maybe going to be less useful. This particular special relationship is maybe going to be less useful as a way of getting things done within the European Union, because though I don't think that Britain is going to be kind of isolated and having kind of really negative conflicts over different things, which they might have been if they tried to repatriate lots of power. They aren't central to a lot of the discussions that are going on, and I think a lot of the running will be made by in Paris probably, and by different sort of coalitions on different issues. I think Poland and Germany, for example, are very important if you think about Russia. But anyway, you've got different constellations on different issues. Britain is probably not going to be a key bit of many of those.
Heather, any big issues that you want to leave us with us, things we could...
I probably wouldn't lead on economic governance, although it will be a topic of transatlantic conversation. I think when we see at the end of this month the G20 baton being handed from Canada to France, we're going to have to fasten our seatbelts, I think, a little bit on that, because I think we do have great differences of opinion on the regulatory environment, hedge funds, derivatives. We've already had exchange of letters between Mr. Geithner and others. That's going to be, I think, a challenging topic of conversation, although we do need to find, obviously, harmonization and standardization. I would pick, and I'm teeing up the next panel, I think the next great project will be the unfinished business of Europe, which is Western Balkans and the post-Soviet space. That is where Europe has, and the EU in particular, has comparative advantage, and it requires vision and leadership, and that is a true U.S.-EU partnership. We've got a framework, but we have no meat on the bones, and we have to create that and provide renewed vision and renewed momentum to both of those strategies. So that's my big issue. On the U.S.-EU summit, very briefly, I only know what I read, and so that was the story was more about how it was communicated and how it was interpreted, which was an amazing cycle, analysis of each side analyzing one another. It's behind us. Let's put it there. My concern is I feel like I'm starting to go back through the same pattern again when I go, well, we don't know if we're going to have, well, when the president visits Lisbon in November, will we be, have an EU conversation? Ooh, I don't know. And again, the anxiety and the uncertainty starts just, the velocity, which will then bring more European leaders here to, are you coming? Are we going to do? What are we going to talk about? Let's break the cycle. Let's, the White House needs to make a decision. I would sort of submit early, build the agenda, drive the agenda, what would both sides find satisfying? But to continue the I don't know, just feeds the cycle of uncertainty, and that's the last thing this relationship needs.
Thanks, Heather. Well, we need to have the certainty of the next panel, because certainly the moderator of the next panel, Steve, is glaring at me now. Cut in. You're not glaring at me, it was just a tired look. Andras, a quick thought about big issues that we could work together on, or any of the other things that you want to leave us as parting thoughts?
I think one big issue would be the reform of the international financial system.
Okay, so you agree on that issue.
For that, we need the Europeans and the Americans to put their act together. But first, the Europeans to put their act together. I don't have a clear view on that. But I think that's essential after what has happened in the last 2 years.
Good. Jeremy?
Thanks. I have a lot to say, but I guess I'll try to condense it in the interest of Steve. Maybe I should respond to Heather's point about the quantity versus quality. I think that it's, of course, right that quality is important. It's a little bit difficult to measure. I would say, channeling Stalin, which is never a very good idea, that that quantity has a quality all its own. And what I mean by that is, if you think about the sort of example that I gave about the Norwegian...
Oops.
He didn't say that. The unnamed diplomat who called me.
Don't worry, they're not in the EU. It's not a concern.
The point about the density there is that he had people to call, that he knew where to reach out to, because, in fact, we had numerous meaningless conversations And this is the way in which the U.S.-European relationship works. It has all sorts of informal contexts which improve on quality, I would say, in ways which are very difficult to measure and capture. And so I would, with that in mind, I'd sort of push back on this notion that the relationship is sort of heading off into some sort of abyss. I think Mark is very right that the transatlantic relations have ceased to be the sort of appropriate unit of analysis for dealing with a lot of the problems that the United States cares about, and that we need other partners to deal with it. But Europe still has a very special place in that partnership, specifically because of the density of the quality of the quantity of the relationship and because of the overlap in interests. We have enormous differences. We fight with the Europeans all the time about all sorts of things. The relationship, as I said, is healthy enough to contain that, and I think it's actually the history of the relationship. Sometimes I hear these stories about, oh, we're fighting about everything nowadays, and I think, you know, relative to what? I mean, as one of the NATO Secretary Generals, I think, once said, people are always coming to me and saying, the alliance is in disarray. When has the alliance been in array? The nature of the thing is fighting. That's what the relationship to some degree is about. The quality of the relationship is not measured by the disputes that we have. It's measured about the mechanisms and institutions we use to resolve them and to reach compromise. And we do that exceedingly well with our European partners. So in that sense, my pessimism about the future is very much tempered by my cynicism about the past. And I appeal to you to keep that in mind. Thank you.
That's very good, Jeremy. And actually, the Norway slip is a good segue also into the next panel, because most people, well, I'm sure not this audience, but I think a lot of people would think of Norway as being a critical country in the EU. In fact, Norway is one of those unincorporated neighbours that feels quite happy being in NATO and being in a variety of other European institutions, but not in the EU. And this is exactly what the next panel is going to talk about. It's how does Europe, in all of its varied forms, and given its complicated history, now deal with the enlargement issue that Andres and others talked about, and then deal with the countries that are probably never going to be part of an enlarged EU, but certainly will be part of Europe. So we'll hand over without any further ado and just ask people, if you want to get coffee, go dash get it and come back, because we're going to do one of those non-existent transitions. Thank you to everybody.